Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we speak with Jesse Mueller. We also review Really, Really, All in the Timing, Luck of the Irish, Adam Gettle at 54 Below, and talk about this week's news. So please stay with us.
If you were 10, which you're clearly not, not that you look old, but you get my. I'll just stop now. Okay, wait, because I had a point. No, I swear I did. Well, I think I did, which is all my life. For since I was 10, I have had a yen for an Irish lass. Because God knows why, like the ancient curse of the Shiksa queens. Do I talk too much? Which is not to say that I'd want Elaine, who turned out to be, when I last checked in, a Republican and a parapsychologist. If you've got a four-leaf clover, you can make my dreams come true. I will be your Hebrew slave, just do the things that Irish girls do.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 24th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Jan Simpson. Michael is a writer and an essayist. He writes for Broadway Stars, the Sondheim Review. He also writes for Talkin' Broadway. You could see his photography at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Jan Simpson. Jan is a writer at Broadway and Me. She was also the co-director of the Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism and a writer for TDF Stages. Good morning, Jan.
Hi, how are you?
To start off this week's show, Laura Mata, Aileen McKenna, Michael Portantier, and I spoke with Jesse Mueller, who will be starring in the Philharmonic's production of Carousel. We recorded this interview on Monday, February 18th. Our special guest today is Jesse Mueller. You all know Jesse because we've seen her currently on Broadway in The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This past summer, she was Cinderella in the Shakespeare in the Parks production of Into the Woods. And last spring, Sweet and Lowdown with Michael Feinstein at Jazz at Lincoln Center. She made her Broadway debut on A Clear Day You Can See Forever opposite Harry Connick Jr. She's also the recipient of the 2012 Theatre World Award and has been nominated for a Drama Desk Award, a Drama League Award, and a Tony Award for Best Performance by an Actress in a Featured Role in a Musical. So, Jesse, what we didn't say is that the New York Philharmonic's production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel is coming up Wednesday, this February 27th to Saturday, March 2nd, and you're going to be playing Carrie Pipperidge. You are rehearsing during the day and doing Drood at night. Is this what's happening?
Yes. You're doing a little double duty right now, as we like to call it.
Well, you know, tell us, how's that working for you? The both of them are pretty demanding demanding schedules.
Well, they're really similar as far as shows are concerned. No. it is demanding, but, you know, you'd be surprised. Everybody is, I think almost everybody involved is super busy, and people are going off to do concerts, and, you know, Kelly's doing her show, so stage management is being amazing and gracious and working with everyone's schedules. And it's just sort of how it works. And they've been really wonderful about helping me out with my schedule, and the people at Roundabout with Drood have been great about letting me do the New York Philharmonic thing. So it's been great.
So there's no possibility that they'll pull something from Drood into Carousel, like, say, you know, let the audience decide the ending. This
I don't know. I think, you know, it's always good to reimagine pieces. So yes, maybe there'll be some improv at the end of Carousel. I don't know. Maybe. Well, you know, Hammerstein, they were always trying new things, right?
You know, in the movie version, of Our Town, the 1938 version, I think, with William Holden and Martha Scott. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but they rewrote the ending.
I've never seen that, but no.
They rewrote the ending so Emily lives. So maybe we could rewrite.
That's a little different, isn't it?
maybe we could rewrite Carousel, and Billy was like, you know, oh, just kidding, you know.
Yeah, right. Spoiler alert, people that are listening. Yeah, what if right before he dies, we just have a no audience members? What do you want to see happen? I don't know, guys. I think you might be onto something.
I did a production of Carousel where the Jordan says, if my Billy Bigelow runs away with Jigger again, I'm going to quit the business. So
there you go.
It happens.
Yeah, I think Jigger needs a, you know, another number. Jigger's turn, that sort of thing.
Jigger's turn.
Expand upon the bromance between he and Billy Bigelow.
Yeah, absolutely. Revisit it, you know, rethink it.
Yeah.
But you know what's so curious to me, and maybe you can fill us in a little bit, Jesse, this is being billed as it's more than a concert production. It has a credited set designer, Alan Moyer, lighting design, Ken Billington, mm-hmm. costume design, David Woolard. So can you give us a general idea of how fully staged it's going to be?
Well, I mean, right now we're staging things. I mean, there's going to be, as far as I know, and people have been sort of rehearsing. We've been rehearsing kind of in different groups and doing what we can when we can. So, as far as I know, there will be a full ballet for the ballet sequence. I mean, some of those other sort of dance numbers, as we know them from the show, are going to be truncated. But there's staging for scenes, and the scenic elements are going to be really, really beautiful. And I think maybe scenic elements is the way to. Is a way to describe it.
Okay.
It's a suggestion, sort of the world that we're seeing. And it was interesting. I was talking to, we were talking about costumes the other day because I had a fitting, and you kind of get to the, it is very specific, and because it's in a world of these people that work so hard and work on the land and work on the sea, you know, it would be interesting. It kind of wouldn't work with the guys. It's somewhat of an easier fix, but you can't really have women coming out in evening gowns, you know, playing mill workers. It's not quite as convincing. So I think it's a really great decision for them to, you know, to go there and make that leap and costume a bit. I think it's going to, I think it's going to help get the story across.
That's great.
So, This production that you're involved with, I just want to run down some of the credits here so that the listeners who might not be familiar with the Philharmonic production that's upcoming, let them know that John Rando is going to be directing it, Warren Carlyle's choreographer. It says Chad Beglin's script adaptation. What's Chad doing? Does anybody know?
It's somewhat of a long piece, and because he's been great about making some really smart cuts for scenes and things like that, and making sure different versions of the text that have appeared, you know what I mean, that we're doing what's truest to the original text, and then he's working on, you know, certain cuts when he can so that it works better in the concert setting.
Yeah. And in the cast, playing Julie Jordan is Kelly O'Hara.
Keep going. I just want to hear you say everybody's name. Because when I think about when they sing, it makes me happy.
We have to pause every time we say Kelly O'Hara. Nathan Gunn is Billy Bigelow. Sethany Blythe is Nate Fowler. Shula Hensley is Jigger Cragen. Oh, Shula. Jason Donnelly is Enoch. And you are, of course, playing Carrie opposite Jason. Kate Burton is Mrs. Mullen. John Cullum as the Starkeeper. And Robert Fairchild as the carnival boy, and Tyler Peck as Louise. So I don't know Tyler. Michael, do you know her?
Well, they're both apparently very, very incredible ballet dancers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have yet to meet them, but it's fun. Every day we see Warren, he just has this delighted look on his face, like, oh, just been working on the ballet, and he's always such a wonderful presence anyway, but he just seems delighted by the work they're doing and just kind of blown away by them. So I'm really excited to meet them and to see what they've been working on.
And how incredible to have John Cullum as
oh my gosh, you know. I was sitting next to him today during the equity meeting. I mean, that was an interesting, I was like, who are you, Jesse, and what is your life? It's really cool. I mean, you don't really think you're going to be sitting next to John Cullum in an equity meeting someday in your life. Pretty nice.
How wonderful.
That's cool. Yeah. Ever think about this, your days at Syracuse and those beautiful weather up in there in the...
Yes, when I weathered the winters, climbing up and down the hills of the campus. No, I mean, it's such a stellar cast. And for me, I don't know. The first day, I think I was a little intimidated, and then I walked away and I thought about that night, and I was like, no, this is going to be a really, really cool learning experience, because just the focus that we can take on the music in this setting is just going to be incredible, and people are going to hear the score in a way that they haven't heard it in the longest time. I think it's 71 pieces.
Oh my goodness.
In the orchestra that we're going to be working with. So it's just going to be such a treat for people. I can't wait to hear the orchestra. I mean, the first time we hear that waltz, I'm just, I'm so excited. But and to hear these singers like Kelly and Nathan and Stephanie and Jason and everyone, I feel bad, like, have I left someone out? But they're just amazing at what they do. First of all, just the gifts that they have with their voices and the technical proficiency that they have is just, it's incredible to watch. It really is.
Well, I got to interview Jessie when she won her Theater World Award for On a Clear Day.
Oh, that's right.
And we discussed the fact that, this was obviously before Drood, so that hadn't even happened yet. So
right.
really, at that point, we only knew her from On a Clear Day. But I noticed that in her bio, her roles range from Adelaide in Guys and Dolls to Amalia in She Loves Me. So I guess this is the first time that New York will get to hear your soprano, huh?
I guess maybe so. A little bit of it in Into the Woods.
But, oh yeah, I guess it's true. A little bit in that.
Yeah. But I mean, even that stuff. This is such an interesting score, and we were talking about it the other day. It's interesting too that you have your lead female character with Julie, and then you have Carrie, who's not. It's a change from Oklahoma. You know what I mean? Carrie's sort of her sidekick, but it's not Ado Annie, and they have Julie sings higher, I would say, than Carrie, but they're both sort of in that soprano range. It's really interesting that he has two sopranos written. So it's been fun to play with the color of things and find some interesting things to do musically while still staying true to the true soprano nature that it's written in still.
That is true. I mean, that is quite unusual, but that's because Rodgers and Hammerstein realized, we can't just make Carrie a mezzo because because Julie's a soprano.
Right. Or make her a belter or something. That's just not what they wanted to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's, we have some questions about Drood. I know that Laura and Aileen had some questions. So you two want to throw some out?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was wondering, we actually have seen Drood a couple of times. It's a show that we love. And the thing that we love about it is that it feels kind of so off the cuff at times. And I was wondering how off the cuff actually is it? Like, is all of that sort of blocked or do you have the freedom to sort of go with it where you want to?
I think definitely by the time you get to the lovers, which is sort of the last segment that we do, I guess you would say, where they pair up one female character and one male character. And I should say the audience does. When I say we, I mean the audience literally chooses. that can be fairly off the cuff. I mean, what's written is a male-female part in the vocal that ends up showing up. And then there are scenes that are written for each character pairing. Every once in a while, there's some improv that goes on. But it's honestly, it depends on the audience. It depends on how the audience is reacting, what it feels like the audience wants, whether they are responding to that kind of off-the-cuff stuff or whether we feel like we need to push forward. It's interesting. I've never done anything like it.
And I was wondering, has anything sort of really, truly surprising happened either in that moment or elsewhere?
We had one night, it was so great. Andy Carl, who was playing the role of Neville at the time, and Cheetah Rivera plays a character named Puffer, and they were paired up as lovers. And so they start their scene, which I don't know, is a couple lines in, and then it was Andy Carl's line. And he just had this look on his face, but it wasn't like dread. It was just sort of delight, and he just kind of off the cuff, he went, I mean, you could tell he went up, and he just went, we don't do this one very often. And the audience just loved it. They just lost it and laughed. And then eventually it was like, and all of us around, because the rest of the characters are sort of watching this occur. And we all laughed. And then he got on it and, back on it. But yeah, so every once in a while things happen that like have never happened before.
I'm told that often the pairing at the end is Cheetah and the 15-year-old kid.
Yes, that also happens. But you know what? It's not her. The audience makes the call. Cheetah just does what she's told.
And the night that we saw it, Helena was actually the murderess on the night that we went. And I was wondering, how often is she chosen?
I guess fairly often. It'll be funny just when you think you've got it figured out, like the rhythm of it all. You're like, oh, well, sometimes I get chosen on Wednesday matinees. It's like it turns on its head and you don't done for 3 weeks or something. But so I don't know. We get a lot of Rosa Murderer, and then I think maybe Puffer is the next.
Oh, okay.
Next popular, and then maybe the two Landless Twins are close runner ups, or maybe Bazzard. Everybody has done it. That's
oh, wow.
Really fun. Everybody has done it. And Rupert Holmes, who wrote the play, he was so thrilled when Bobby Creighton, who plays Durdles, got to do his confession. And he's done it twice, I think. And Durdles never did his confession in the original Broadway production, I believe.
Wow.
He was never chosen. And he's gotten to do it twice in the revival, which is really fun.
The recording is so fantastic, Jesse.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. They did a beautiful job. And Paul Gimignani, our maestro, he really took good care of us and made that happen. And all the people at the Roundabout were really, really worked hard to make that happen. So we're all really proud of it. Thank you.
Good.
Great.
So did you have a question about Into the Woods, Laura or Elaine?
Oh, yeah. The question that I actually wanted to ask about Into the Woods is that I loved the sort of very modern approach to the characters in that. Like, they were, yes, they're these fairy tale characters, but I felt like, you know, we looked at them and we kind of like knew these people. And, you know, Cinderella is sort of, her sort of ambivalence about the prince felt so modern to me. And I was wondering if you saw her that way, if you sort of know that girl. It was very interesting to me and I love that.
Oh, that's cool. I think that was definitely, a consideration also in the design of it all, because there was a lot of talk about that, about being able to recognize the people when they went on stage. I mean, like, oh, well, that's Cinderella, and that, and maybe not even right off the bat, but a couple scenes in, you know, a couple lines in, to be like, oh, that's the Cinderella, and that's, but yeah, to also have elements of, something relatable.
Yeah.
You know, not fairy tale in the Disney sense, but because that's the brilliant thing about that show, I think, is the thing that you have to remember is that we love fairy tales because they're relatable.
Right.
Fairy tales, I mean, they're so universal, and a lot of those fairy tales that happen in that play happen in, those stories exist in so many cultures, so they're just really universal. I mean, Cinderella's all about I wish or I want. They're want stories, and hers is rags to riches, and I think everybody can relate to that. Everybody always finds themselves in a situation where they wish things could be better. So I don't know. I think that's where I started. I felt when I did it, I also just felt, I don't know, I felt very, very close to that storyline and the kind of, to me, I think my way into it when I got to do it, which timing wise I was so happy about, was just, I'm not being very eloquent, but it had to do with, you think you know what you want and then you get it and it's so different. Where you think you should want what everyone else wants, and then when you finally get it, it's just different. Sometimes it doesn't fit. Sometimes it doesn't fit you. Sometimes it makes you uncomfortable instead of happy. And I think that's sort of what happens to Cinderella in that play. That's the after, happily ever after. You know what I mean? I think she realizes that maybe this is not what I want. Maybe this is not what I need.
It was. I read something today that, speaking of fairy tales, that I had never heard of before. Albert Einstein said, "If you want your children to be smart, read them fairy tales. If you want your children
to interesting.
If you want your children to be really smart, keep reading them fairy tales." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Wow, I've never heard that Einstein had said that before." And it worked in it actually relates pretty well to Into the Woods.
That's quite an endorsement. That's quite an endorsement from Einstein.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's fascinating, because I think sort of in our modern world too, we still have this obsession with it. And when I said something about Disney earlier, please don't. I am the hugest Disney fan. I'm looking at a Tinkerbell mug on my kitchen counter right now. And there's that thing about, I think, you know, as women growing up too, of, gosh, you know, are we doing our little girls a disservice by telling them princess stories and your prince will come and all this, but I don't know. There's something beautiful in fairy tales too, especially just the wide range of them. So many of them are about morals.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great thing to take away from them.
As somebody who's been to Disney World 6 times this year, My wife's got a Disney problem, definitely.
Hey, that's okay.
But we take our kids. My daughter just said, you know, she's five, and she turned around and she said, "Can we go to Disney this weekend?" I'm like, "Are you?" Go this weekend. Come on.
You trained her well.
My wife has trained her well.
yes, indeed.
When did you graduate from Syracuse?
I graduated 05.
So you came out of Syracuse and you did On a Clear Day and then Into the Woods and Drood and now the Philharmonic. Is this just tremendously exciting for you, or is it that you had this plan in your head? Some people have this plan. I'm going to do exactly this by this point.
Wow. You know what? I did not. I also was blessed to have an amazing career in Chicago. I went back to Chicago, which is an amazing theater town, right after school.
Sure.
Yeah. And I got to work. I got really lucky and I started working right away. And I learned from those experiences. And like you were saying before, I got to do roles that I think a range of roles that I don't think I ever would have gotten to do if I'd come to New York right away. Not that that's good, bad, or different, you know, whatever it is, but that was just the way it worked out for me. So I learned so much working.
I see by your bio, you worked at the Goodman, Chicago Shakes, mm-hmm. Writers Theater, Marriott Lincolnshire, Drury Lane, Court Theater. I mean, these are such A-list theaters. It's such a...
Yeah.
It
was amazing. I actually did a production of Carousel with the Court Theater that was in, and they did it was a dual production with Longworth Theater.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it's been interesting to revisit it because that I can't remember what year I did that, but you know, it's funny when you, it's very cool. I think maybe this is the first time coming around to a show again. Mm-hmm. And seeing it in a very different light, depending on, you know, what's happened to you since you did that show, and just like the lens that you sort of see it through now.
Well, another one of Jesse's roles that I didn't mention earlier was, and God, I would have loved to see this, Veruca Salt in Willy Wonka.
I had the best pink, it was like a bubblegum dress. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
Where was that?
That was at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. Sure. That was part of their young audiences program that they do there. Did it one summer. We had a ball. A bunch of, you know, it was just a great group of people. And it was neat. We had there was a lot of puppetry in the production, which was like very cool. And the kids loved it. Yeah, and I just got to be a brat. It was very fun.
And
I got to play an Oompa Loompa. See, I didn't put that. I should put that on my resume.
Are you doubled?
Well, it's very complex, guys.
Okay.
I was Veruca Salt being an Oompa Loompa because the Oompa Loompa was a puppet.
Oh, I see.
I think that's how it worked. I'm trying to remember.
They're doing a new version
of
it.
It was very layered.
They're doing a new version of it in London now. So who knows? Maybe we'll see it on Broadway, but I think it's a different.
Yeah, I would think it would be a fantastic stage adaptation. If you know what I mean, if you brought more of it from the book and
right,
probably
right.
Have to write. I mean, there's some songs in the movie,
and then
but you'd have to write more music, I would think.
Yeah,
from Willy Wonka to Henry IV, parts 1 and 2. So
I think it's a natural progression. you know, no, that was yeah. That's what I said. I've been very blessed and lucky. I don't know, right place, right time.
Well,
and it was, that was fun. I had this amazing guy who taught me Welsh, and I sang and spoke in Welsh and that.
Right place at right time, but people keep hiring you because you're great. And
thank you.
We're all big
fans. I love to do it. So,
fans. So thank you so much. Really enjoy Carousel.
I am.
You have, you must be tired when you wake up in the morning because you're doing so much, but please come back and visit us when you do your next project. And thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to visit with us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure, you guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Jan got a chance to see Really, Really. So, Jen, did you really like it?
I really did.
Really? Really?
Yeah. This is a play by a new young playwright. He's 27 years old. I believe this is his first produced play. It was originally done down at the Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia, last year. But this is a brand new production. His name is Paul Downs Colaizzo, I believe is how you pronounce it. He has the very good fortune to have this production directed by David Cromer, who is probably one of the best theater directors working today. And he also has a really high wattage cast of young actors, because the two main stars are Zasha Mamet, the daughter of David Mamet, who is also starring in the HBO series Girls, which has been getting a lot of attention. And the male main guy is Matt Loria from the show Friday Night Lights, which a lot of people really loved. The story itself, though, of the play is enough, is provocative enough, even without all of the director and the high-profile actors. It's a story that Colaizzo, as I said, is 27, and he did the first draft of this play when he was in college at NYU's Tisch School. And it was right around the time, you may remember, when members of the Duke lacrosse team were accused of gang raping a woman who they had hired to do a strip number at one of their parties. And that's not the exact scenario, the exact plot here, but it does involve a group of college students. There is a wild party one night. The play opens when two young women are returning from the party. One is really sort of giddy, and the other one is sort of dazed. The next morning, the woman who's sort of dazed says that she has had sex with a really popular, good-looking, very wealthy guy on campus. The problem is that she is engaged, and she's engaged to one of his teammates and one of his very good friends. When this friend has been away on a family trip, when he comes back, he finds out about the encounter. Understandably, he's angry, and she says that she was raped, and that sets off the drama. Colaizzo really wants to talk about young people today, young people in their early 20s, their view of life, and he has a really very tough view of the people who are in his generation. He sees them as totally narcissistic, totally self-involved. The all of the characters, it becomes almost like a Rashomon. Each of the stories that the characters are telling changes a little bit, and so does the audience's sympathies. A lot of people have responded kind of negatively to this show. They say everybody is unappealing. They don't like the characters. That seems inconsequential. You don't have to love the characters to find the story compelling. And I think it's a really compelling story.
Well, it's always tough when you go into a show with a very serious topic like that. Did you come out tired, or did you come out having new questions or seeing a different point of view?
One of the things I didn't talk about that he's very concerned with is class. And I came out thinking a lot about it, because the woman, the school is never named. It's pretty clear it's kind of an Ivy League college, university. She's a scholarship student. She's from a very dysfunctional family, we learn as we go on. And all of these other guys, are, including her roommate, they're all from well-off families. And they're very concerned about their image, about getting ahead. She's very concerned about getting in to that class, that level. And so what people are willing to do in order to make it in this society is what I came out thinking about. And so he brings you in with the whole idea of the he said, she said, who was right, was she raped, was what or not, was it consensual. By the end, that ceases to matter. What's more interesting and more involving is how these young people see the society, the country that they're about to graduate into.
Did they make a very clear parallel between the Duke case, or was that
no.
kind of tangential?
It's really just the idea of, is what this woman said about the sexual encounter true?
Yeah. Well, it seemed to be that was central to the Duke case as well, and also race played into the Duke case as well as class. And Duke is, you know, considered on par with many Ivy League schools. So it's interesting that it's sort of a rift from the headlines, but maybe it's got its own spin on that.
This weekend, I think the last performance, not of the play, it's been extended through March 24th. It's an MCC production down at the Lucia Lortel Theater. But this weekend, one of the actors, the only black actor in the production, and his race is never mentioned. He's just part of the team. But when the production was done in Arlington, it was that character was also played by a black actor. I haven't seen the script, so perhaps it calls for a black actor to play it. But that actor is filming a TV pilot this weekend. And so Paul Kalaitzo, the playwright, who is not black, is filling in for that character this weekend. He did three performances.
That's always interesting to be able to compare and contrast that. All right, so let's move forward here. Michael, you got to see a production of All in the Timing at 59 East 59. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, I guess this is the play, or I should say plays, that made David Ives' reputation some years ago, but I had never seen or read it. It's, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 short plays with one intermission. And they are really delightful, and one could see why they made his reputation. Starting with the first one, which is a date between these, well, actually not a date, I mean, depending on how you look at it, this man and woman confront each other in a cafeteria or a restaurant or something like that. A cafe, it says in the program here. And it shows how exactly what one says, you know, might continue the conversation or not. And so this man named Bill and this woman named Betty, Bill is played by Carson Elrod and Betty is played by Liv Ruth. They, for example, Bill will say something, you know, like, may I sit here? And then her response might be one of several things. But every time he then responds, if he says something that doesn't go over well, we hear a bell, and then he says something else until he says something that continues the conversation rather than shutting it down completely. And that's a very clever device and very well done by the two actors. I would actually say some of the plays, including that one, in a way, I mean, they're extremely well done and well written. They're almost more skits than plays, one might say. Specifically, there's one called Philip Glass Buys a Loaf of Bread, which is extremely hilarious if you know anything about Philip Glass, with all of the actors in very odd costumes, doing very, very strange, you know, sometimes epically slow movements, and indulging in this incredibly weird, symbolic, repetitious dialogue over and over, and doing these ritual kind of movements, and it really is very funny. I don't know if I would describe it as a play, but you know, I mean, I don't know if that really matters what you call it. It's just very well done. I must make a shout out, especially to the actors, and particularly Carson Elrod, and also Jen Harris, the wonderful Jen Harris, whom we've recently seen in Silence, the musical, and several other things, because the nature of the writing, it must be incredibly difficult to memorize this stuff. I described the first play and how it just really goes from, you know, from one variation to the next in split second, rapid fire bursts of dialogue, and I'm sure that's very difficult. And then there's another play it's called The Universal Language, where Jen Harris plays a woman who comes to Carson Elrod as Don to learn this this universal language that he's propagating, and much of the play is in this other language, which is like a kind of a bizarro, hilarious, strange version of Esperanto, and they both do it so incredibly well. It's really you would have to see this play if only for the acting, but it's, you know, as I say, it's very well written as well. It's really kind of amazing how talented these people are and how well they do it. Directed by John Rando, I must say. So yes, this is at Primary Stages, and I highly recommend it. And just a little anecdote. I don't know how amusing this is, but I'll tell it. It's not that long. The show is at it's a Primary Stages production at 59 East 59 Theaters, and as I'm sure some of our listeners know, they have a bar on the second floor of the theater complex that has become something of a destination. It's very nice setup, and I got to the theater quite early because I was coming from something else. So I went after I got my ticket. I went up to the bar, and when I got there, there were three other people there: the bartender and one couple seated at the other side. And so I sat down, and who comes walking up the steps but Stephen Sondheim, which is not terribly surprising because he is currently working with David Ives on a new musical. So I assume that was part of the reason why he was there. And so he ordered whatever he ordered. And then John Wideman, who was Sondheim's collaborator on a couple of musicals, came up, and they started talking, and they sat at the bar, and Sondheim sat right next to me. And the two of them began to discuss several things that, you know, I didn't really eavesdrop that much, but I couldn't help it. It was kind of, you know, it's always kind of a thrill to be in the Sondheim presence. Especially, you know, like so close with few other people in the room. That was my latest Sondheim encounter. I must say, you know, I've seen him several times at the theater, you know, at other people's shows, even when he doesn't necessarily have a connection with anyone involved in the show. So he seems to be a real, real true, you know, theater fan, and gets out and sees a lot of stuff. And I think that's fantastic.
So you didn't tackle Sondheim and say to him, "Hey, whatever happened with Gold or Wise Guys or what it ended up being?"
Well, what happened is that they did about three or four different versions of it, and I assume that it's now considered a done deal.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I say what happened to it, I mean, oh, you yeah. know, it 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 seemed like it should have gone much further than it did, but I saw the show in a few incarnations and we're happy to leave it where it is and have him move on to something else.
Yeah, you know, he had talked about Groundhog Day at one point, writing a musical of that. And that's interesting because in a way it's something like All in the Time, the first play I was mentioning in All in the Timing, where people like kind of keep reliving moments and trying to get them right. I don't think that's what this project is. I don't think we have a lot of information on exactly what they're working on. But I'm sure everyone is very, very anxious to see what that's going to turn out to be.
All righty. So Brushes with Greatness. I have to hang out with Michael more often.
Well, as I say, no, really, Sondheim, he really goes out to the theater a lot. I think he should be applauded.
Especially if you hang out on the east side, you're sure to, east side in Midtown and Turtle Bay, you're sure, certainly, if you keep your eyes open, you'll run into him.
Absolutely. I've seen him at several, it seems like every time I see him, it's not a Broadway show, it's an off-Broadway show. So make of that what you will.
All right. So next up on the list of things to talk about is that Jan got a chance to see Luck of the Irish at LCT3. So Jan, tell us about the Luck.
Well, I love that theater, first off.
Isn't it beautiful?
It's a wonderful little theater sitting up on top of the Vivian Beaumont. It's lovely just to be in that room.
Before you get into the show, is it easier to get in and out of the theater? There seems to be a lot of traffic when it first opened to get to little...
It's difficult to get to because you have to go up
elevator.
The elevators. They won't let you walk up or walk down.
I'm told that it's of a very big chronic problem that they don't know how to solve by someone who is involved in the theater on some level. And I've had my own bad experience with it because the last time the only time I went, one of the elevators wasn't working and it's hard enough as it is. For some reason they did not incorporate, a public staircase in the design. The only one apparently is like a fire stair, way in the back somewhere. And as Jan says, they will not let you use it even if you volunteer. So I don't know what they're going to do. It's too bad.
All right, Jan, I interrupted you. So
sorry.
Tell us about the show itself.
This is the third production that they've had in this new space, and the other two were really good. So I was really excited about seeing this. And the playwright for this show, The Luck of the Irish, is a woman named Kirsten Greenidge, I think. Greenidge, perhaps you say her name more correctly. And she did a play last year. I think it was Milk Like Sugar. Did either of you see that or remember it? And it was an interesting play. So I was interested and eager to see this one. And this one was less successful for me. It's perhaps unfortunately for her. She says she was working on this play and then Clybourne Park came out. And she said, because it deals with a subject very similar to Clybourne Park. It's set in two eras, in this case in, I think, the early 60s, and then today, late 50s and today. And in the late 50s, there is this affluent black couple. He's a doctor, and they want to buy a home in a white suburb of Boston. It's a suburb that excludes...
Restricted.
Thank you. That's the word. A restricted suburb. And they come up with the idea, which seems to have been a common practice, and well, not a common practice, but a practice, and one that Greenidge's grandparents actually used when they bought their home, where a black family will get a white family to buy the house. They will give them the money, buy the white family buys the house, and then signs over a deed to the black family, and the black family moves in with the hopes that the neighbors will now just accept it now that it's a done deed. Literally a done deed. And so that's what happens in this play. They find a working class Irish family who are really sort of hard up for money. They agree to buy the house. Once they've bought the house, the wife has some second thoughts. The Irish wife. She feels that they're not being compensated enough and that they should hold off on turning over the deed until they're given more money. And this family, she feels, can afford it, and they should profit from this as well. The play opens in the present. The original owners of the house have died. And they've left it to their granddaughters, two granddaughters. One is married. One has just completed graduate school. And the Irish man who originally bought the house comes to visit and says that he and his wife feel that now it's time for them to claim the house. They didn't ever really sign over the deed, and they want to claim the house. And that sets off the drama. It goes back and forth between the two eras, unlike Clybourne Park, which was just the 50s in Act 1, the present in the second act. This bounces back and forth. It also takes some detours into the lives of the granddaughters that seem unnecessary and a little confusing. It, because of the detours, it becomes a little diffuse, and so the energy goes out. You're sort of interested in this battle between who owns the house, the families, and what they feel about what they're owed. And it just, the energies just sort of gets a little fuzzy as they bounce back and forth.
So it's a, it's another angst-filled night, or is there a,
One of the things that I'm finding really interesting, because there have been a number of these plays now, and I see some more are on deck to come in, is that plays that have dealt with race have been really sort of either heavy-handed about it in the past, or really sort of taking a moral stance. And we've had a number of plays come along where it's more complicated. We had The Submission. Did you guys see that last year? About the white playwright who submits a play. A woman. Then we had, obviously, Clybourne Park, a couple of others, and this one, where the issue of race becomes more complex and really forces, I think, all of us to sort of think about our own views and how and to be maybe even a little more honest than we sometimes are about these things. So it's interesting. It was
Don't forget the play that was called Race.
Yeah.
I
don't want to forget that one. I was thinking before when we were having the discussion, when you were trying to find the word, that actually is a very funny line from Auntie Mame. I don't know if I'm going to quote it exactly, but Mame goes to visit the Upsons in this very, 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 very white conservative area of, I guess it's supposed to be Connecticut, isn't it? And at one point, the Upsons start talking about they want to buy the property next door in order to keep it out of, quote unquote, the wrong hands. And Claude or his wife, Upson, say something like, well, you know, of course, this area is completely exclusive and totally restricted. And Mame says, exclusively what and restricted to whom?
Yes, I do have that. Yes.
So I guess both of those words are perfectly fine. I'm really looking forward to I would love to see Luck of the Irish. It sounds very interesting. I was in apparently the vast minority on Clybourne Park. I thought it was extremely overrated. I didn't think it was done well at all, even though I thought the concept was wonderful and really, really interesting. And it sounds like this one is the same situation. So I'd really like to try to get to see that.
So it's playing at LCT3, as we talked about, through March 10th. And hopefully, Michael, get a chance to see that. Let us know if you do.
Yeah.
One thing Michael did see is Adam Gettle at 54 Below. And a bit of a transforming experience, Michael, is it?
Oh, my God. It was amazing. He was there for, I'm not sure, for several performances this week. And he did double shows, I believe, on Friday and Saturday. I didn't think I was going to get to see the show because I had something booked every night. But then I realized he had 11 o'clock shows on a Friday and Saturday. So I went last night. Can you imagine? Except it wasn't an 11 o'clock show because it was so popular. And when they do late shows, obviously they have an issue at 54 Below where they can't let people in until the other show is finished and they've done their cleanup, et cetera. So I got there at 10:25 and there was a line down the block, halfway down 54th Street, almost to well, not almost to Broadway, but a good distance towards Broadway, and then they started, you know, to let people in groups. But the show, it took quite a long time, and because it was absolutely packed. And I saw Jason Robert Brown there. I saw a lot of other. Liz Calloway and her husband were there. A lot of really interesting people. Word had obviously gotten out, including a rave review in the New York Times, and I think some other really good reviews. So it was amazing. Adam himself did a lot of the singing, and he has a wonderful voice. And aside from being so charming and so good looking, I don't know if you all know it, but he actually was a boy soprano, before his voice changed. But unlike a lot of boy sopranos, he continued to have a wonderful voice after his voice changed. And he's sung on several, recordings and appearances before. And then he had as his guests Whitney Bashor, Bashor, who, you know, was just transcendent in terms of beauty, physical beauty, vocal beauty. At times she sounded freakishly like Kelly O'Hara. And of course, that's a tremendous compliment. And one role that they have in common is Clara in The Light in the Piazza. I believe that Adam said he saw her do it in Philadelphia somewhere. And he was so bowled over that he, you know, he got her as one of the two singers to do this show of his, which is an incredible compliment when you think of all the people that he knows, all the incredibly talented singers and actors that he knows. And Stephen Pasquale, who I've said many, many times, has one of the most glorious voices in, you know, that I've ever heard. And not only that, but it can sing just with melting beauty in just about any different style you want to name, you know, operatic, semi-operatic, jazz, standards. I even, I haven't heard him do much of this, but I've heard that he's even great when he's doing rock type songs. And he was available because, well, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, his new TV show was a huge ratings flop. Do No Harm, in which he played a Jekyll and Hyde kind of surgeon who literally like switches personalities once, you know, and back once each day. That did not go over.
Your two episodes, yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to say, apparently has a very good sense of humor about it, because he tweeted something about how few people were watching it. And I got to speak with him briefly after the show, and I said, you know, that was amazing. I said, I'm sorry about your show. And he said, I'm not sorry about it. And I made the point again that, he's one of those people where, I mean, obviously doing a TV show is financially far more remunerative than doing a cabaret or even a Broadway show. But the way, and of course that, you know, he has to make a living and he's married and that's very important. But from an audience point of view, there are so many people who could do, you know, who might have been in that Do No Harm show. Whereas there are so incredibly few people who sing with such beautiful tone and such intelligence and such heart that he brings to everything he sings. He made an album of like jazz and pop standards from the American Songbook. That's just, it's spectacular. You would think that that's his main career focus, and that he does nothing else, because how could he do this so well if he also, you know, is an actor and does TV and does rock and operatic, semi-operatic musical theater. But to make a long story short, he said, I hope we have you back more often, meaning, you know, singing on stage. And he said, I'll be back. I have plans. So we'll see what that turns into. But the show was, as I say, packed to the gills. And it consisted of wonderful solos and duets from Floyd Collins and Light in the Piazza and Myths and Hymns, but also really, really intriguing, wonderful snippets from two new shows that Adam is working on. One is called Billions, based on a film that I did not see. And
Film is called Billions?
Billions, yes.
The film is called Billions, or the show, or are they both called Billions?
I think it's both. I know the show is called Billions. Am I getting it wrong?
No, I'm just questioning. I hadn't heard about it.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think it was a blockbuster, Cineplex blockbuster film. But the other film that he's writing a musical based on, I'm sure you've heard of, is Days of Wine and Roses.
Ah.
So they were both amazing. He even joked about the fact at one point he said, "I'm slow," meaning that he has a reputation for really spending a long time getting shows right and being very meticulous in the writing of them. I know that The Light in the Piazza was in development for a really long time before it was first produced, and then it was produced in several different places, and I think there were changes along the way. So he is not the most prolific composer in the world, but it's, you know, I guess it's incredible quality as opposed to quantity. And it does my heart good to go see a show like that and see it sold out and hear all this amazing stuff coming, because you know, there's a lot of really, really bad stuff happening in musical theater today, especially on Broadway, because of reasons we've discussed many, many times, with the having to appeal to the lowest common denominator. But a universe in which composers like Gettle and Jason Robert Brown and Pasek and Paul, you know, and of course still Sondheim and all of the Lacusa, I hasten to mention. It's good to know that they are here, and that their stuff, you know, hopefully will eventually get produced somewhere and buck the tide of this really, really kind of waste of time artistically stuff that we're seeing on Broadway.
All right, so that's Adam at 54 below. Let me see here. It's through yesterday, so he's closed already.
Yeah, that was. I went to the last performance.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully, maybe it'll make it around. He'll take it out again or go somewhere else about it. So, Jan, you were telling us a little bit about Smash before we started, and we thought maybe we should record this. So what's happening on Smash? I have to admit that I haven't really watched much this season.
Well, it's come back, and as everyone knows, Teresa Rebeck has moved out as executive producer, and they brought in the guy from Gossip Girl to sort of revamp the show. So a lot of characters and a lot of actors were moved out. Some others were moved in to not much avail, because the ratings aren't any stronger and perhaps even a little weaker than they were last year. And the quality of the show really isn't any better than it was last year. But what they did last week was, it was a little inside, but mean, actually, I thought. The character that Deborah Messing plays on the show, the actress Deborah Messing from Will and Grace, is a lyricist and a songwriting teen and a book writer for the musical Bombshell. That is the musical about Marilyn Monroe that was the focus of season one. And this season, they brought in a script doctor to look at the Bombshell book and improve it. And he's played by the very appealing Daniel Sunjata. And he spent the entire episode just telling her how terrible a writer she was, how she had no idea of structure, how she didn't have sex and appeal in her show. And it was really a not so veiled, a pointed commentary on Rebeck herself. It was a little uncomfortable actually watching it.
So
Daniel Sunjata played the script doctor.
I know.
That does not sound like very on the nose casting for me.
They're just, you know, telegraphing that like crazy. He's going to be her love interest, so they're going to have, you know, hate you, and then they'll fall in one another's arms if the show lasts long enough for them to do that.
Well, this is what I was thinking, is that each week we see these little updates about falling off ratings for Smash, and so perhaps moving Miss Ray back out was not the best idea that they could have done for this. But
I think it's sad that they, you know, the show had so much potential if they had only gotten a good writer or a team of good writers. I would call everyone's attention to Submissions Only, a web series that you may be hearing a lot more of, because it was created by Andrew Keenan Bulger and Kate Weathered, and it's got a lot of really fun people in it, including cameos by some really big stars. And it's a behind the scenes theater series, but the reason you maybe be hearing a lot more about it is that word came recently that Kevin McCollum has come aboard. I forget exactly what his title or role is, but he's going to be behind the show, the really wonderful, smart producer, Kevin McCollum. So I don't know if they have plans of maybe trying to bring it to TV, or just they think it's better to stay where it is as a web series and just,
It seems that the first two seasons of Submissions Only have been financed through Kickstarter, and they're coming into the third season, and they wanted to start doing stuff in HD, high-definition video, and Kevin is he's either put in some money or has raised some money for this, and he's also doing some contract negotiations and, you know, running the business side of it.
Right.
They're starting to work out some new contracts with SAG and various things like this. So kind of taking it from this great idea that that they had to start and turning it into a business. And so the behind the scenes of what's happening on Broadway, whether it be through Smash or, you know, in somewhat less of a way, Glee, and then now Submissions Only, and there's a handful of other things that are out there. But it seems like people are, just as we saw with the independent film movement out in Hollywood, with lots of people, you know, taking on their own, starting their own projects, now that this is happening with a lot of Broadway folks as well.
Well, back to...
If they did it on cable, I think being on a broadcast network, they've got to get such high ratings, they've got to appeal to such a wide mass audience. If it were a cable show, a show like Girls has about 2 million people watching it, and yet it has, you know, it's a very high profile because it's attracted a certain audience. I don't say that a show about Broadway would necessarily attract the same audience, but it could live with a smaller audience and then really play to that audience and not have to worry about the sort of soap opera-y parts of it and appealing to a lot of people who may not just be as interested.
And Submissions Only is, you know, more of a comedy than the other types of than you would say Smash is not really a comedy. It's more of a drama. McCollum says in the Variety article that Submissions Only has about 50 to 70,000 viewers per episode, which is actually
pretty for the internet, no?
I'm thinking remarkably low.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, our podcast, This Week on Broadway, reaches nearly that amount of people. So it's interesting that that they're able to, you know, finance something out of this, although the video portion of it lends itself more to a commercial aspect of advertising.
Sure.
So, but I'm sure that it's attracting 50 to 70,000 right now, but you know when they grow it, something's going to happen at some point where it's going to pop and it's going to be in the hundreds of thousands and, you know, approaching a million views per episode, and that's when it'll start being worthwhile to advertisers. I mean, 50 to 70,000, you can't bring that to an advertiser, a major advertiser, and say, you know, we're going to monetize this, because Even at a high CPM, a $30 CPM or something like that, that's still not a lot of that. They're still not breaking even on this process.
Well, it really, I urge everyone to watch it. It's just fantastic.
It's wonderful.
And you have a good point, James. I think maybe it's very wise of them. I think the fact that it is an out and out comedy was a very smart decision on their part, because it seems like that in the case of Smash, for example, when they try to get into the serious stuff, that is often when they just go off the rails. I haven't seen Smash since the first episode, because there were a few things that happened even there that to me that were just so unbelievable that I just could not take it. But one good thing that has happened, I must say, and I did see the clip, is that Joe Iconis, who's an incredibly talented up-and-coming musical theater writer, wrote a song. Well, I think he may have written more than one, but the one I heard was one that Jeremy Jordan sang, and it's and everyone seems to you know seems to love that song, rightly so. It's really fantastic. So hopefully, before you know, if Smash does die, hopefully before it does, it will have given a, you know a real boost to Joe Iconis's career and you know his presence in the industry.
I think Slick and Paul have written for them too.
Well, those are two other really great people. So that so I think they got and of course Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman. It seems like the part they got right was the people that they hired to write the songs. the part they got wrong were you know the people that they hired to write the scripts. So that's unfortunate.
The book is always the problem.
Yeah, just like
so,
musical.
Just like musical.
So maybe it's a reflection of of musical theater. Right?
So you mentioned Jeremy Jordan and Smash, and we had other great news about Jeremy this week. Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Oh yes, they're making a film of the last 5 years, which is of an absolutely wonderful, very heartbreaking, but also hysterically funny. Show by Jason Robert Brown, and that was interesting that the announcement came this week for several reasons, but one being that the show is about to have a revival here in New York, and with two different people. but I mean, I think that I've always said, and I'm not the only one, that the last 5 years could make a fantastic movie. Because not only are the songs so great, but because of the concept that it charts a relationship in two different directions at the same time. As the to make a long story short, as the show opens, we hear the first song is sung by the woman, and it's right after her 5-year relationship with the man has ended, and it's a very beautiful, very sad song. And then we switch to a scene of the man 5 years earlier singing right as he meets this woman. And then as the show progresses, the woman's story goes backward and the man's story goes forward. And at one point they cross over, obviously in a beautiful scene that takes place, in a boat, I believe, on Central Park Lake. And then once they cross over, then, obviously then they keep moving in the same direction. And
screenwriter.
I'm sorry?
Seems like a challenge for a screenwriter.
Well, I wonder about this because, you know, fans of the last 5 years have taken recordings of it and re-edited it to put them parallel instead of opposite directions. So I wonder if they're going to leave, when they shoot the film, if they're going to leave it intact, backwards and forwards, as Michael described. But I'm supposing that they will, because other news is that Sherry Renee Scott, who played Kathy off Broadway, is producing the film.
With Kurt Deutsch, her husband.
Her husband, Kurt, yeah. So, and Kurt and Sherry own Chickaboom Records. She's the Sh and Chick, and he's the K and the K. So they're producing a film, and so it's going to be interesting to see if they stick to that or if they reorganize it, because that was one of the large criticisms of the show when it was played out at Northlight in Chicago and they came in. But it's become a great resource for regional theaters. Everybody does it. You need a piano and two and a boy and a girl, and it's a very beautiful, simple show to do.
I have no doubt in my mind at all that they will keep the original structure. I think it will be that much easier to make it work on film. One solution that some productions have come up with is to just have the date you know, projected on a wall or whatever, as it goes along, to just to help people keep track. And also, I mean, if you went into it not knowing what, you know, what the trajectory was of the two, you know, of the two characters, I would imagine that if you really didn't know it at all, that you might be quite confused for a while. But if you do know it from the beginning, I really don't think it's that difficult to you know, to keep your bearings. And Jan, I'm not sure if you know this show, but there is, as written, the show has absolutely no spoken dialogue. It's literally just a series of songs.
This is a screenwriting challenge.
Yeah, it is. So we'll, I'm interested to see. I'm dying to see the second stage production of Last 5 Years. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm looking forward to the movie. And I think I've said before, Last 5 Years, one of my favorite shows. And Jason is one of my favorite writers.
And there also, I mean, I must say, no one has more respect for Jeremy Jordan's talent than I. I mentioned that I saw him in his first professional production. Basically, he was in a show, in the production of The Little Dog Laughed, in, I think it was in Stanford somewhere. But he does not immediately strike me as right, perfect for the role in the Last 5 Years, for several reasons. One is that, being that he still reads so young to me, even though he's actually in his late 20s. I think he reads even younger than that, which is why he was so wonderfully believable in Newsies. Also, the character in The Last 5 Years, somewhat much is made of the fact that he's supposed to be Jewish. And in fact, Adam Kantor is going to be playing the role in this revival we're discussing. So I don't think Jeremy comes across that way. On the other hand, the role was created off-Broadway. The off-Broadway production, the failed off-Broadway production, was Sherry Renee Scott and Norbert Leo Butz, who I think many people would say and did say does not, you know, come across as Jewish at all either. So I'm interested to see. I hope that that Jeremy is does wind up being, you know, believable in the role.
All right, so we've actually gone on much longer than I anticipated, but we do have a handful of news things that I want to touch upon before we go. So give me a quick takes on this. Jane Lynch, who were talking about Smash before, about Glee before. Jane Lynch is going to be starring in Annie as Miss Hannigan coming up. So what do we think about that?
Has the potential to be fun.
Yeah. Michael?
Well, it can only be, hopefully, an improvement. The show is so, so poorly directed by James Lapine. All of the charm, almost all of the humor has been taken out of it. So maybe if Jane Lynch comes in, they'll let her do her own stuff and be funny in the way that Katie Finneran might have been if someone who knew what they were doing had directed the show.
Okay. We also have spoke last week or is it week before with Celia Keenan Bolger up doing Glass Menagerie at American Repertory Theater Art at the Art, and there's talk about a Glass Menagerie transfer, which we sort of thought we sort of asked her about and she kind of begged off on, but it looks like it might happen. I guess they're lining up those things. So might be that. Michael, you didn't get a chance to go see it, or did you? Because the snowstorm.
No, I missed it because of the snowstorm.
So maybe you'll get to see it now.
She told us that they canceled 3 performances. But I'm going to Boston this weekend, unless we have another snowstorm, to see it. So you know, hopefully I'll get to see it, even if it doesn't come in. But yeah, when we asked her, I think the way we phrased it was, I said something like, "We're waiting to hear if it's going to come in this season," and she said, "You and me both." So you know, I you know, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
They still haven't announced a theater, although there are a few available. So it's got to be. I mean, we've got to know soon, one way or the other. I think it will. It just the reviews have been so rapturous and then it hasn't been such a great year for revivals of plays. So I think they could do very, very, very well in the Tony Awards. And aside from that, you know, just give New York a wonderful production of a beautiful, beautiful play.
Other things that have been announced is that Les Miserables coming back to Broadway in 2014 in March. Surprised or not surprised?
Not surprised, but I can't say I'm excited either.
They say a new version reconceived, so I wonder if they're going to put that horrible song from the movie in, or what they're going to do there.
Well, I don't know, and also they seem to not be selling it this way, but there is a tour out right now, so I can only assume it's going to be that production, at least in terms of the sets and the costumes and all the, you know, the physical production. I wonder if they'll do any recasting. Jean Valjean, I believe, is being played by Peter Lockyer, who has a beautiful voice.
Yeah.
But there again, it's not what I think most people are used to seeing as Jean Valjean. He too, although he's been in the business for quite some time, reads very young, which maybe that's good for the, you know, I mean, the character is supposed to age quite a bit over the course of the show. So maybe at the beginning they have him, you know, pretty much in light makeup, and then it kind of increases as it goes along. It would be interesting to see if they retain the whole cast, or if they do any recasting when they do bring it to Broadway.
Michael, here's something you could have asked Mr. Sondheim.
What's that?
Merrily is transferring to the West End from the Meunier Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yes.
And we since we talked about in the very beginning, since we first heard the announcement that Merrily was going to be at the Meunier, we've been supposing that it's going to end up on Broadway. So I wonder if it's going to make its way from the Meunier to the Harold Pinter on the West End to some Broadway theater next year. We'll have to see about that.
Well, it's so many people have been trying. I know the Roundabout had as a goal for quite some time to try to do Merrily, and for whatever reason, they didn't. Then the Encores production, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of buzz that they were hoping for a transfer, and that didn't happen. So maybe we'll get it from England like we do so many other productions these days.
And something that our earlier interview, Jesse Mueller, forgot to tell us, that she's replacing Kelly O'Hara in Nice Work If You Can Get It on Broadway. So that we talked with Jesse, as we mentioned before, on Monday evening, and I think this was announced on Tuesday evening or Wednesday.
Yes.
Was
so she probably couldn't tell us.
So that's great. That's also good news there. And then finally, to finish off our discussion today, Orphans. Hmm. What are you going to say about Orphans? It seems that that Ben Foster is going to be replacing Shia LaBeouf and in Orphans, and that there's been a lot of fireworks around how Shia left the production. And do you think that this is going to, you know, after opening night, is this going to help or hurt, or will it matter? What do you guys think?
I think it's going to matter. I think people are going to come primarily to see Alec Baldwin.
Sure.
So, you know, that's it. But I read somewhere where someone was giving Shia LaBeouf the Jeremy Piven Award.
Yes. I think that was Mr. Riedel that gave him the Jeremy Piven Award. I think it was Mr. Riedel's column. So, yeah.
Well, except it seems like everyone involved in this has been much more honest than Jeremy Piven. So in that sense, it doesn't really apply. I mean, they said creative differences, and it really does seem like that's true. There was a specific report that Mr. LaBeouf, put his hand through either a wall or a door, depending on who you read, in the course of a rehearsal. And he was in character at the time. It's not like he just had a temper tantrum. But people were concerned about maybe that he's not, you know, disciplined enough for stage acting to do something, you know, to do a show like that 8 times a week. And so it might just be as simple as that. And, you know, plus maybe personality conflicts added to the mix.
I think it was the tweeting that people were referring to, the fact that he put out personal emails where people in the cast and in the production were being, I think, supportive of him and trying not to say, you know, you're a bad guy, saying
right.
You're a bad guy. But they were saying it personally, and then he puts out their emails. So I think that's where he got the pivot.
Yeah, I think that.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. I see. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the story would have gone away in one or two news cycles, but it seems to have taken on a whole life of its own because of the post-tweeting, the post-leaving the production or fired or however you want to couch it. Then he started tweeting, Mr. LaBeouf started tweeting about that, and it's hard to let that story go once there's scandal.
True.
Once there's scandal. All right. So anything you guys want to mention before we go?
Well, I should mention again, Carousel is this week at the New York Philharmonic for several performances. And then it's also going to be filmed or taped for later telecast. So if you don't get to see it live, you will get a chance to see it on TV. And that should be great because it sounds like an amazing cast. Nathan Gunn, Kelly O'Hara, Jason Danieli, Stephanie Blythe, John Cullum, et cetera, et cetera. And Jesse Mueller as Carrie Pimbridge. And then, as I say, I am planning, you know, barring unforeseen circumstances, to see Glass Menagerie on Saturday in Boston. So I'll give a report on that. And then, I did an interview last night with the lovely Elaine Page. That's going to be on an interview for Talkin' Broadway because she has a solo concert coming up on Saturday the 9th at Town Hall, in which she's going to sing all of her hits, which is kind of an amazing thing considering who she is, because her hits, songs that she introduced, include Memory from Cats, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, and she was the first Evita in London, Chess, the songs from Chess. And she has been on Broadway a few times, most recently in Follies, most notably in Follies, but we haven't seen her that often, and we haven't seen her do really any of those signature roles that I mentioned. So it will be amazing for many people to get her to hear, her sing those songs all in one concert.
All right. Jan, anything to mention?
No, I'm going to see a lot of things this week. I'm going to see Passion. I'm going to see, the Old Boy, A.R. Gurney, mm-hmm. of that. And The Revisionist, the Jesse Eisenberg play, in which he co-stars with Vanessa Redgrave.
Wow. That's sounds like it would be a fun week. All righty. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us outside of iTunes, you can get us through the Stitcher app. That's Stitcher, which is for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and listen to us streaming. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. All the information and some of the stories that we talked about are on our page, which is at BroadwayRadio.com. We have a bunch of links to different stories that we've talked about today. That way, if you want to check anything out, you can find one spot to see it there. Also, contact information for Michael and for Jan, for me, and for anybody else who's been on the show. So, on behalf of Michael Portantier and Jan Simpson,
This is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.